Even though they're the strongest, they're always the jerk.
Yeah, like when you think about it, like Vulture is the end of the line. I was eating the end of the line.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and today we've got two slightly unusual stories that we've tied up under the theme, It's a Man-Eat-Man World. We all know the concept of dog-eat-dog, a world marked by destructive competition without ethics, where one must eat or be eaten, in a metaphorical sense, of course. But what about man-eat-man? History is scattered with reports of cultural cannibalism, of people eating the dead for cultic reasons or grieving rituals. Lost survivors of shipwrecks, plane crashes, and Arctic missions have been known to resort to cannibalism as a last resort for survival. And some scientists have even put forward the idea that Neanderthals, thousands of years ago, may have been eaten by more modern humans. But it's unconfirmed. We're collectively fascinated. Cannibals have made their way into our imaginations through films like the infamous Hannibal Lecter, and even our childhood stories like The Witch in Hansel and Gretel. And then there's the zombie, the already dead, threatening an all-out apocalypse and feeding and thriving on human flesh. The term zombie originally comes from Haitian folklore. It meant a dead body that's been reanimated through witchcraft or magic or science, kind of like Frankenstein's monster. In 1929, an American author, William B. Seabrook, wrote about a man who encounters voodoo cults in Haiti in his book, The Magic Island. And after the book's release, zombies suddenly became part of Western pop culture, transforming into these flesh-eating monsters, the ones you see in cult films like The Night of the Living Dead. A few years ago, the US Center for Disease Control and Prevention even published a graphic novel about how to prepare for the zombie apocalypse to demonstrate the value of food and water and medical supplies in the case of a natural disaster. And today, in Australia, we have Zedtown.
I want to do real bad things with you.
Zedtown is, in a nutshell, the biggest real-life zombies versus humans game in the world. Over 6 hours, armed with Nerf guns and foam darts, alliances are made and broken, witches and super zombies are released, survivors turn on their fellow humans, and by the end, few, if any, have survived. So why do hundreds of everyday city dwellers get together, decked head to toe in costume, to play a game like this that they're highly likely to lose? For All the Best producer Tegan Nichols, there was only one way to find out.
Sergeant Tegasaurus to Courier 6. Come in, Courier 6.
Go for Courier 6.
Courier 6, just after a situation report over there.
Copy that, kit squared away, weapons locked and loaded, ready to roll on Operation Zedtown in your command.
Copy that, Courier 6. Let's do this thing.
This is actually the way there. It's like right there. That's Anzac Parade right up there.
Oh, cool.
I know.
On the weekend of September 17, 2016, some friends and I piled into a car and headed to the University of New South Wales. Today, we weren't just friends. We were a squad. We were the Vault Dwellers, complete with code names. And for most of our squad, Courier 6, a.k.a. James, Whiskey Rose, a.k.a. Kira, and Sergeant Tegasaurus, that's me, this wasn't the first time we'd devoted an entire day to running around a university campus and fighting for survival in the simulated zombie apocalypse that is known as Zedtown. We had played this game before, but the new additions to our squad, Spob the Ghost and Mr. Surprise, a.k.a. Marty, well, let's just say they were first-timers. But on this day, it really didn't matter if you were a veteran or fresh meat, because none of us had ever played a Zedtown this big. With 1,000 players expected to show, we had no idea what to expect.
Once again, hello. Just a quick note, we will be starting as soon as we clear this queue. We've got like about 150, 200 people still to get through.
We arrived to a sea of people, with bright yellow Nerf blasters slung over their shoulders and strapped to their thighs and tucked into holsters under their arms. Pretty soon, the game begins.
To reiterate, we start with the golden rule, and the golden rule is simply, don't be a dickhead. What do I mean by this? I mean that we are all fully grown adults, and we're all playing with toys that are sold to ages 8 and up.
Having arrived late, my squad and I were still buckling on our gear when we heard an announcement.
May have been listening to all this news of the affliction coming down from the northeast, or some sort of virus, or the end of days. I don't take much stock of that, but all I got to say is Concord has been through worse. We will survive long, long into the future. Oh, maybe we don't need a new election. I can see our excellent sheriff is alive and well. No, he's dead. He's very dead. Okay, you better run. We got the zombies coming.
So before we knew it, we see zombies emerge from behind the waiting registration crowd. These are the OZs, the original zombies, and they're the ones that start the infestation. Within the first hour of the game, these guys are pretty much our biggest threats. Needless to say, we all ran for safety.
That's a nice start. Oh, he's
dead. Sergeant's log. The game has just begun. We've already lost one. We've lost separated. Whiskey. Been separated from Whiskey Rose. There was a bit of a zombie ambush at the town meeting, and everyone has fled. It'll be an interesting game.
I think that gaming is a way in which people enjoy constant feedback of incremental success. We like to close loops. We like to see progress in our lives. And gaming is usually a system of rules with very tactile feedback. Games transport you to places and situations where you can thrive, but you don't necessarily get to experience.
Luckily, the separation from Whiskey Rose was only temporary, but it was enough to put us all on edge, on high alert, and become suspicious of everyone.
Sergeant's log.
It's amazing. The graphics special.
We suspect that the suspicious character from before is an original zombie. He's been in hot pursuit of groups, and he's not showing any signs of hesitation. Our plan is to scope out our environment, get a map in our mind, and hopefully try and find a faction or a group to buddy up with.
Players say that the reason that they play are for those moments of intensity where they're actually feeling like they're making life or death decisions about whether or not to leave friends behind, split up, thinking that they may not see each other again alive. All of, I guess, our goals are to keep it while playful, also create something where stakes are real, because that's a big part of the game for people.
Spob, do you want to tell us what happened?
Some chick was like, oh, that's my friends. Like, five-ish kind of friends.
Who got them?
Alpha zombie in, like, a pink tutu. It was actually her and then a guy with long hair.
That's my friend, so I'm just going to... I'll follow you guys. And I kept saying to the others, guys, come on. She could be one. She could be one. Like, no, I asked her to come along.
We have picked up a stranger and we think that she's a zombie. Potentially an original zombie. Can we just let it go away?
Masons are up that way.
She has information. She knows too much.
She was an OZ. She was an original zombie. And she just took my cousin. Oh, Marty. I can't believe she turned you into a zombie. How do you feel? How do you feel?
No. Disappointed.
I'm only allowed to come.
Let's do it. Mr. Surprise, welcome to the zombie uprising.
I'll see you later.
Bye!
Calling Mr. Surprise to see if he's a zombie. Are you a zombie? Okay. I take that as a yes.
My only sunshine, you make me happy. When skies are gray, you'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my
But our sheriff is Hersey Mason. All hail the new sheriff. Think my
head is glowing. So the whole goal, I mean, immersion is the goal. We want to create an environment where You can suspend disbelief if you want to, and we want to make that as easy as possible. So the music and the fact that we have a dedicated radio station is there so that people can feel like they are actually part of the apocalypse, and that it's the zombie apocalypse is bigger than the university they're playing on, because it's being reported on the news and it's all around you.
We just got some information from a Red faction member that Red and Yellow are teaming up to take out Blue. Our squad at the moment is currently factionless, and we're not really sure that we should actually join a faction.
Oh, we have finally found
so much, like, more crowd. So what do you do?
You're a faction member. You're factional missions, yes.
Like what?
Like, right now we have to protect our glorious leader.
Right. Who's that?
What makes him so glorious?
He became the mayor. He's in a brown trench coat. We like him very much.
Okay.
Do you want to become a member of the Red Team?
What are the advantages?
Nothing.
Factions was something we jumped into early, and it was to solve a problem with the game, which was that there's zombies everywhere at the end of the game, and it's so exciting, but at the beginning of the game, there's not that many zombies, and it can be a little bit boring walking around if you don't see a threat. And so we didn't want anyone to have that experience, so we just, you know, taking a cue from things like The Walking Dead, where you have to fear humans as much as you fear the undead, we said, well, let's straight away divvy up the humans into three factions. Let's make them antagonistic of each other. We did not anticipate how much the players get into it.
Maybe we should join someone.
You think?
Like, it's getting to the point where we don't really want human enemies as well as zombie enemies.
We've always been very much against the Reds.
I know, but hence we haven't found the Blues.
We did, but they were disappointing.
Did we?
Yeah.
They were disappointing. Kira?
No, I reckon we stay either undeclared, or we've been blue or yellow, but we've always hated the Reds. I just think if you want to be part of a faction, not the Reds.
Yeah, I think it's
even though they're the strongest, too. Even though they're the strongest, they're always the jerks.
Yeah,
as well.
That's the only thing.
How are you feeling now?
I'm tired. Not so stressed though. I feel like the inevitable's gonna happen pretty soon, but I've calmed down. I think I've run out of adrenaline.
I'm feeling very cold, as the sun has disappeared hours ago, but the running is keeping the energy levels up. This is the quiet before the storm.
How are you feeling, James?
Confused. I don't know what our odds are. I don't know if the balance has tipped. And I'm still angry. Still out for green blood.
Players fall into the archetypes. So you're there with your friends, but then 3 hours later, one of your friends is the gung-ho grizzled sergeant who's going to get everyone killed. One of them is the almost having a fit, you know, close to snapping person who we need to get out of here alive because they can't look after themselves. You know, you've got the second in command. All of these kind of roles. Nobody sits down and says, okay, who's going to be squad captain when they go to Zed Town? But they find themselves fitting into roles that they've seen in a Romero film or in The Walking Dead or any of the, you know, hours of zombie genre material that we've put out in our infinite wisdom. When I say we, I mean like civilization.
As the game progresses, it gets darker, it gets colder, and the zombie count rises. Our squad found its way up to a rooftop, and there we found some remaining survivors. We could hear the zombie hordes running rampant across the campus grounds below us. 18,900 hours, and night has well and truly fallen. We are maintaining our position on the roof. A whole bunch of survivors have abandoned our position, and the zombie horde has grown in confidence. So we're not quite sure what to do. The great thing about live improvised gaming is that the rules can change at pretty much any time. As few survivors had stayed with us to defend the fort that we'd established on the rooftop, our group became concentrated at a choke point atop these long, high, wide stairs. Zombies were gathering at the base of them. At that point, a game moderator came by and told us that the boundaries of the play zone had just been changed. We were now out of bounds. This meant that the only way back into the game was down the stairs, down the tall flight of stairs which had about 30 zombies waiting for us at the base. We had no other option but to accept our fate, and so we went out firing.
Go, 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 go.
Oh, fuck.
Blaze of glory!
Stand and fight, guys!
Step up.
Run, James!
We fought with courage, but pretty quickly we were all taken by the zombies.
Oh, man!
Join the horde!
I'm dead.
I swear.
All right. How many of us died?
I think all of us.
Some people come to Zed Town with completely unrealistic blasters or not enough Nerf darts because they don't really care about that, but they'll have a really strong, grounded idea of who they are in the world. They will have a group of friends that they want to experience this with. You know, having to provide for yourself and those you care about and get them out of an impossible situation is something that sort of speaks to some primitive part of all of our brains. The thing we hear again and again and again is the takeaway that makes people come back is that there's nothing like it, that it's unforgettable, and that they had a moment in Zed Town that they'll remember forever. And that's really exciting.
Thank you for playing Zed Town!
That story was by Tegan Nichols and was made with special thanks to the creator of Zed Town himself, Dave Harmon. If you're keen to get involved, check out their website, zedtown.com, for future games. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and today we've got stories of survival in a man-eat-man world. So last week on the show, we were telling stories about food and how it brings people together. And this week, we've got something a little different. Inherently, we're all pretty aware that food is for survival, but generally humans eat more than their fill, and more often than not, we're motivated by taste. But how weird can one person's food choices really get? One of our producers, Bonnie Tai, spoke to Jack, who, for the purposes of this story, we'll just call by his nickname, who has some pretty unique views about animals and which ones should end up on your plate. And before we jump into this story, we'd just like to give you a warning. Some parts of this story can get a little gruesome and shocking, and we certainly don't recommend or condone the behaviour we're about to describe.
So I recently met this guy. His name's Jack. And he is kind of an urban legend in my friend group. I'd describe him as that friend of a friend that you always hear about in crazy stories. And for about 5 years, I'd listen to these stories and think, there's just no way this guy really exists. But a few months ago, when I was out at a friend's birthday dinner, his name popped up again. And well, the story I heard about him wasn't exactly the most polite of dinner time conversations. But it was enough to cement the idea in my mind that I had to meet him, and I had to hear the story again, but this time from him.
I've lived with tribes, I've been in war zones, I've dealt with very peculiar characters.
That's Jack. I've just arrived at his North Carlton flat in Melbourne after boarding a plane from Sydney the night before so I could finally meet this guy in person. Now, Jack is a guy who has spent the last 9 years travelling. He has visited over 50 countries, and one of his favourite pastimes when travelling is to eat any and every animal he comes across, no matter how bizarre. He's eaten fox.
Picked it from the motorway a few months ago and just butchered it.
Dog.
In many countries, actually. The heart is absolutely exquisite.
Cat.
Cat is actually one of the top five in my list.
And whale.
In Norway and Japan, the very few places where this is still at least domestically legal.
To name a few. And while he recognises that his eating habits aren't exactly conventional, it's not the shock value or the challenge that motivates him.
One of the reasons why I do this is for you to feel part of the ecosystem and actually understand your role in the food chain and your role on the planet as a biological entity. So I basically expose myself to whatever it is that I don't like, even to the point of literally gagging on it and feeling ill, until I acquire the taste and like it. Because after you do that, you've literally forcibly expanded your hedonistic spectrum, at least for food, to the point that you learn how to enjoy more things out of life as opposed to fewer.
Jack tells me that his quality of life has improved exponentially since he started eating this way. In fact, it's led him to question why, when it comes to mammals, Westerners limit ourselves to just eating what he calls the trifecta, chicken, pork, and beef.
Yeah, you could have turkey sometimes, or venison. This starts to get already quite boutique. It's really the trifecta. You know, if somebody told you that you could only eat pears, apples, and bananas your entire life, you know, they're pretty good. I'm quite a fan of bananas and, you know, pears and even apples sometimes. They're all right. But, you know how many more fruits are out there? But if you are richly raised, since you're a kid, thinking that it's only acceptable to eat these three fruits, and media reinforces it all the time, you go to shops, there's only these three kinds of fruits, anything else will look weird. There's literally tens of thousands of different species on the planet of things you can actually eat. And none of them is going to kill you, besides maybe pufferfish, which I also had, and a few other things. You can eat all of them. And your body's designed to digest all of them. And you only have apples, pears, and bananas. It is preposterous. And we haven't even talked about insects or even other things. There's literally countless options for you to enjoy and connect to the world in terms of eating things. And once I discovered it, I was mind blown. I said, I'm just going to eat anything I can in all possible ways with literally no restriction.
Since he first began experimenting with exotic food choices, Jack has compiled a list of over 100 different animal and insect species that he's savoured from all around the world. He tells me that with every city or country he visited, his obsession for eating a new animal only grew stronger. It eventually reached the point where he wanted to try animals that are considered taboo or even cursed in some cultures, such as the vulture in the Choco district of Colombia.
This was in El Valle, the Pacific coast.
And what is the superstition that the locals had about the vulture?
It's very simple. To them, the vulture, or the so-called gallinazo, that's the cursed animal. You just don't look at it, you ignore it. So basically, you just try to have as little interaction with the cursed animal as you possibly can.
After he applied some serious peer pressure, he managed to convince a friend in Colombia to head into the jungle with him and shoot a vulture dead for dinner.
So it was like me and him now in the jungle searching for the cursed animal. Every now and then he would stop, look at the ground and just think, what am I doing?
They eventually find a group of vultures drinking by a watering hole. He shoots, killing his prey. He takes the dead bird into a nearby village and convinces a woman to cook it for him.
And then she starts basically gutting it in a similar way you do with chicken. Pluck the feathers, and once you unfeather a vulture, it's quite insane. It looks like this skimpy, weird creature, all naked. It's just one of those things you could never really picture until it's in front of your eyes. And then, yeah, open the chest, guts out, and yeah, the smell was literally unearthly. It was absolutely shocking. And even for me, like, we all had to run away. It was a bombshell.
But despite the putrid odour, Jack still ate the vulture whole.
Basically, vulture doesn't taste like anything else. It really doesn't. Because really, vulture only really tastes like death. It's a scavenger. So I was scavenging a scavenger, really. And when you think about it, the food pyramid, there's nothing above vulture. It's not even us. Nothing eats a vulture. Maybe other vultures, but maybe maggots, yeah, that kind of thing. But then the food pyramid becomes very complex. But yeah, like when you think about it, like vulture is the end of the line. I was eating the end of the line.
Full disclosure, I am not a very adventurous eater at all. I don't even eat seafood. So I couldn't really relate to Jack's stories or his desire to eat strange things. After the vulture incident, Jack says he became even more curious about further pushing the boundaries of unorthodox flavours. And that's when he decided to investigate a very peculiar taste, his most taboo yet, human. And a fair warning to you all, this is where it begins to get a little graphic. After doing a fair bit of research, and I shudder to even think about what he would have had to Google to come up with this conclusion, Jack made up his mind that if he were ever offered the opportunity to try human flesh, that he'd do it. Just the once. If it was done consensually and there was no serious harm to the donor. It would be the final frontier in his quest to taste all animals. But he didn't have to travel far to reach his goal. Who would have guessed that the opportunity would present itself in a cushy suburb of Melbourne?
This happened with one of my best friends.
Jack's friend, who I won't name for privacy reasons, was fascinated by body modification. And for those unsure about what that exactly means, body modification is the practice of deliberately altering your anatomy to achieve an ideal aesthetic. Basically, it's anything from extreme piercings to getting implants on your forehead that resemble horns. Yes, it's a thing. Jack tells me that this particular friend had grown up around a blue-collar crowd, with men who brought home the bacon by working with their hands. He said that due to the nature of their job, working with sharp tools and such, that it wasn't uncommon for these guys to come home with a missing finger or two. And having been surrounded by so many people with missing limbs,
he felt he needed to lose at least a digit somehow. He wanted to sacrifice one of his fingers to fulfill his inner body image.
So here we have one guy, Jack, who's pretty keen to taste human meat, and another guy who was willing and consenting to donate some. The situation was perhaps a strange, maybe unprecedented coincidence. So how did they finally go about it?
His initial idea was to favour some sort of accident to make it happen.
But Jack says that they quickly dismissed that idea, because staging an accident to lose just a finger could have potentially resulted in him losing more than he bargained for.
With an accident you're trying to pursue, you probably blast half a hand off. Like you, it's not how it works. It would become many folds more powerful as a thing. You wouldn't just lose a finger. So it was actually a very unsafe train of thought that had to be addressed somehow. And eventually we realized, well, we might as well just get over and done with it and just do it.
So what proper. Did you do?
So purchased a cigar cutter from the US that looks like a guillotine. And then me and him one night followed through with a few other friends as support and proceeded with the amputation. The thing basically turned into a bullet and shot away.
Let's just be clear. The thing that Jack is referring to here is his friend's middle finger.
And apparently there was not much pain associated with it at the time. It took a few seconds to kick in. Then immediately drove him to A&E, where he was admitted for sudden loss of finger through mysterious ways. We had to come up with some sort of story of weekend shenanigans turned a bit wrong.
Jack's friend was sent home from the hospital a couple of days later, where he was welcomed back with a traditional Aussie barbecue, with a twist.
And then, you know, we set up a very Australian barbecue with some charcoal. I bought a little iron cast pan And I had a bit of a thing. I chopped some tomato and parsley.
To serve alongside his friend's finger, which at this point was chilling inside a Tupperware container, nestled between their milk and butter in the fridge. But I'll spare you the real gory details on the cooking and preparation, because having seen the pictures, I'm telling you now, you just don't want to know. Despite this, though, there was something that I was morbidly curious about. And that was, well, the taste.
Human meat is actually very sweet meat, especially if you consume a Western diet full of sugar and whatnot. Very sweet meat, and it has a very distinctive taste that I will never forget, which is just human, really. And I cooked it with no condiments and anything, so I knew that that was just human. And it was very rich, very chewy, because even
at this point in the interview, someone walks into Jack's bedroom, interrupting our conversation. So I switch off my recorder. I greet the guy and make polite chit-chat before something strange catches my eye. A missing middle finger. It was the donor himself. He and Jack exchanged a few words. The conversation was weirdly normal. Then he mumbled a quiet, "Nice to meet you," in my direction and disappeared just as quickly as he appeared. It was surreal meeting the guy, even if only for a fleeting moment, because though I had flown here to speak to Jack about this very incident and spent the day looking at pictures and watching video footage from that fateful night, it wasn't until the donor stood right in front of me, stump and all, that I realised that this wasn't just some weird story. It was something that really happened. And that is a truly shocking realisation to have.
That story was by Bonnie Tai, with help from supervising producer Selena Shannon. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon, our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton, Tegan Nichols compiles our show, our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie, Beck Fari is our SYN Production Manager, Michael Bryden is my co-host, and I'm Jess Hamilton. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can also find our archive at allthebestradio.com. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.